Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. In his discussion of the cosmological ideas in the third part of his Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics, Immanuel Kant is going to consider two of them as what he calls dynamical, dynamische, antinomies. And both of these have to do with causality, which is one reason why it's going to be dynamical as opposed to mathematical. And just to review a little bit, each of these contains a thesis, a Satz, and an antithesis, a Gegensatz, a contradictory proposition. And, you know, ideally they both can't be true at the same time. That's the way we look at contradictory propositions. That's actually not going to be the case for these dynamical antinomies. So the third, first of the dynamic ones, is there are in the world causes through freedom as the thesis, and then as the antithesis, there is no freedom, but all is nature. So everything is either caused in a, you know, determinism, or there's like little spaces where there's some freedom possible within it. That's one way to interpret it. The second of the dynamical, the fourth of the antinomies proper, thesis is in the series of world causes, there is some necessary being. The antithesis, there is nothing necessary in the world, but in this series, all is contingent. So necessity and contingency are being opposed to each other as well. And notice it's not saying everything is necessary. It's just saying there has to be a necessary being, or everything is contingent, could be other than it is. A necessary being is one that is the way it is of necessity, including its existence. It has to exist from necessity. It must exist. It couldn't not exist. So Kant is going to draw a really important distinction here between the mathematical antinomies and the dynamical antinomies. He tells us in the first class of these, the falsehood of the presupposition consists in representing in one concept something self-contradictory as if it were compatible. In the second, we're reversing that. It's, in some respects, the opposite. The falsehood of the presupposition, the Voraussetzung, what it is that we're assuming, is that what is compatible, vereinbar, what can be unified, is represented as being contradictory, widersprechend. So the first kind, we were not noticing that there is a self-contradictory concept that we're beginning from. In this case, there actually isn't a contradiction. There appears to be, it's represented as such, but it isn't actually going to be contradictory. And so he's going to go on and say, in the first case, the opposed assertions were both false, but because of a mere misunderstanding, misverständnis, right? Both assertions, which are being opposed to each other by that misunderstanding, they can actually both be true. Not only can they be true, Kant is saying they are actually true, both at the same time. So how is this the case? He says, okay, mathematical connection necessarily presupposes homogeneity, gleichartigkeit, things being of the same kind, quite literally, or a similar kind or comparable kind. So it presupposes the homogeneity of what is connected. The dynamical one, he says, doesn't require this. As a matter of fact, not only doesn't it require this, the things that we're comparing aren't of the same kind, even though we might be misled by using the same word, like cause, Ursache in German. So he says, the connection of cause and effect doesn't actually require homogeneity. It can be found sometimes, right? When a similar thing is the cause of an effect. So think about a mechanical process, right? You got mechanisms producing effects, you know, or events in other mechanisms. Great, that's all on the same level. But cause and effect doesn't have to go that way. It's possible for there to be not similar, not equivalent types of causes and effects. So the concept of causality doesn't require homogeneity. So what assumptions are going to make the contradiction unavoidable? The incorrect contradiction. He says, if the objects of the world of sense are taken for things in themselves, if we assume that we're talking about things as they are behind the appearances, when we're actually talking about the realm or world of appearances, and then going further, we take the laws of nature. Laws of nature are ways of understanding causes and effects, right? This cause leads to this effect, and it does so in this way. If we take the laws of nature, which, and remember, nature for Kant includes the phenomenal realm, what it is that we can experience. If we take those laws for the laws of things in themselves, the things in themselves can have laws, but they're not going to be the same thing as the laws of nature. So if we make those mistakes, those assumptions, we're going to wind up with these antinomies, thinking that one or the other of them has to be true and the other has to be false, and then trying to use reason to get our way to them, and then being quite upset when we find out that reason can make a case for both of them or make a case against either of them at the same time. So what is our way out of this problem? And I should point out here that Kant is going to devote a lot of discussion to the third antinomy, very, very little, just a summary discussion to the fourth antinomy. And perhaps what we ought to understand here is that the solution to the third is really providing us with almost everything that we need, just a little bit of content missing for the fourth. So the third antinomy, is everything determined, or do we actually have free causes that emerge from freedom within the ordering of things, not things in the world, but things in a broader sense. So he starts out by saying, in appearance, every effect is an event or something that happens in time, right? The effect must, according to the universal law of nature, be preceded by a determination of the causality of its cause, on which the effect follows according to a constant law. Okay, so far, so good. So we've got cause, the cause determines the effect, it precedes the effect in time, the effect arises in time. Notice, time, right? The phenomenal world. So he goes on and he says, this determination of the cause to causal action must likewise be something that takes place or happens. So the cause must begin to act. Otherwise, the effect as well as the causality of the cause would have always existed. So the determination of the cause to act must also have originated among appearances and must consequently, just like its effect, be an event, which means it must have its cause. So we can now get a whole chain of causes and effects where each member of the chain is both an effect of preceding causes and a cause of following effects. And this all happens in time. So far, so good. I think this is pretty non-controversial. This is often how we represent causes and effects to ourselves. So where's the problem there? Well, it seems like natural necessity must be the condition according to which efficient causes are determined. So where would freedom be? It can't arise anywhere in this long chain of appearances that we call causes and effects. Can it? Because if it did, it would violate this necessary law of nature, right? So, you know, this is happening within time. Natural necessity applies to it. Where do we get freedom? Freedom itself, Kant says, is a cause. If freedom is to be a property of certain causes of appearances, it must be a faculty of starting them spontaneously, without the causality of the cause needing to begin, and hence needing no other ground to determine its beginning. And then he says, the cause as to its causality, the cause of freedom, must not stand under time determinations. It doesn't happen within time. It happens outside of that. So it cannot be an appearance. And he says, it must be considered a thing in itself. The free cause that causes free choices, actions, determinations, whatever you want to call it, that then get inserted into the phenomenal world of appearances is happening outside of that as a thing in itself. And so he says, if without contradiction we can think of the beings of understanding as exercising such an influence on appearances, natural necessity will attach to all connections of cause and effect in the sensuous world, but freedom can be granted to the cause, which is not itself an appearance, but the ground or foundation of appearance, right? So, you know, this is going to be quite important, and he's going to talk about a faculty that does this. This connection, he says, is expressed by ought. If you know Kant's moral philosophy, you know exactly where he's going with this. You don't need to go to section 3 of the groundwork of the Metaphysics of Morals, where he's, you know, essentially saying similar things to this. You know he's talking about Vernunft, or reason. Reason determines itself. Reason is a higher faculty than the understanding or sensibility, which are connected with this world of experience and structure it, right? Reason takes us beyond that. And in this case, reason can actually yield us free causes of effects. So he says, insofar as we consider a being, human being, entirely according to this objectively determinable reason, he cannot be considered as a being of sense. Rather, this property is that of a thing in itself, and we cannot comprehend the possibility of this property. I mean how the ought, which might never have yet taken place, should determine its activity and could become the cause of actions whose effect is an appearance in the sensible world. And he's going to say something really interesting here about the freedom. I mean, it sounds like, well, you could push this back further and say, well, you're appealing to this ought, so reason when it's following the ought is actually being determined by that. So it's not really free now, is it? Maybe it's freer when it doesn't obey the ought. And Kant says, yes, both. When it's obeying the ought, when it's making that ought its own, it is acting out of freedom. And when it doesn't do that, as he says, when the action is not performed on principles of reason, which we call maxims, it is subject to the empirical laws of sensibility, but in the first case, you know, acting according to maxims, reason is the cause of these laws of nature, therefore free. In the second, the effects follow according to mere natural laws of sensibility, because reason doesn't influence, but reason itself is not determined on that account by the sensibility, and is therefore also still free. So it's a free cause whether it determines or doesn't determine, if it just lets things happen the way that they are. So he says, what's the upshot of this? Freedom is therefore no hindrance to natural law in appearances. Neither does this law abrogate the freedom of the practical use of reason, which is connected with things in themselves as determining grounds. We are things in themselves as such determining grounds, right? So, you know, he goes on further, but I think you get the gist of what he is saying here. I'll just remark one other thing that he says here. It says, we are able in rational beings or in beings generally, so far as their causality is determined in themselves as things in themselves, to think of a faculty of beginning of themselves a series of states without falling into contradiction with the laws of nature. We don't actually have a contradiction there. Why? Because one of them is happening in time within the realm of appearances, sensibility. The other is emerging into that from outside of it. Now, what about the fourth antinomy? He says it's solved in the same way as the conflict of reason with itself in the third, so we can apply a similar logic. He says, provided the cause in the appearance is distinguished from the cause of the appearances. So we've got two different things. Cause in the appearance, in a chain of causes and effects, right? And then we have cause. Maybe we want to put a capital C on that. That is the cause of all the appearances. That could not itself be an appearance. That couldn't be within that series or structure of causality. It has to be outside of time and space and experience. So he says we can reconcile these propositions. One of these is that there's nowhere in the sensuous world a cause, according to similar laws of causality, whose existence is absolutely necessary. The other, that this world is nevertheless connected with a necessary being as its cause. So, you know, a necessary being, a being whose existence is necessary, a Wesen in this case, right? So this is signifying whatever we want to call it, you know, the originator of everything, the cause, capital C. You might call this God, although Kant's a little cagey about that sort of thing. We're going to see this discussed a bit in the theological idea, whose discussion immediately follows these. So these are the dynamical, as opposed to merely mathematical, antinomies of pure reason, which lead us into, at least with the third one, into morals, into thinking about ourselves as being things in themselves. And then we could think about that other being, that Wesen, as a thing in itself as well, but a different kind of thing in itself, a completely necessary being. Both of these are compatible with having a world in which causal determinism actually holds. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.